Ohio will have a new attorney general months before voters pick a winner in November. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, what that could mean for other GOP office holders. Plus, key statewide primary results in Ohio, the power of President Trump's endorsement in Indiana, and how Mika Owens defeated incumbent Stephanie Sumrow Dumas in the Democratic primary for Hamilton County Commissioner. Then we remember cable news pioneer and Cincinnati native Ted Turner and hear how a local radio station became the real WKRP in Cincinnati. Joining me now to kick off the news review are Ohio Public Media, State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be with you, Lucy.
Great to have you. And Indiana Capital Chronicle Deputy Editor Tom Davies. Thanks for being here, Tom.
Thanks for having us.
Joe, just days after Ohio's primary election, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost confirmed he's going to resign to accept a job in the private sector. Did this come as a surprise?
Well, kind of, yeah. Karen Kassler was one of the first on this story. Attorney General Dave Yost has 8 months left before his term ends in January. He can't run for re-election to that office. And you remember last year, he ended his campaign for governor. So he's told the State House News Bureau that his last day as AG will be June 7th. Hmm. And he's going to go serve as a VP of Strategic Research and Innovation for a Christian conservative legal group called Alliance Defending Freedom. And if you remember right, Yost has taken a lot of legal actions on behalf of the state that sort of align with the mission of this organization. I'm thinking banning trans kids from sports, that bill, trying to uphold that, also trying to uphold the ban on gender-affirming care for minors. And he's been very anti-abortion, again, aligning with this group. So his resignation letter to Governor DeWine is brief, and it just says he's going to pursue another employment opportunity.
Well, you mentioned that he started a campaign for governor early last year. What made him decide to drop out of that race?
Well, if you remember, the Ohio Republican Party very quickly got behind Vivek Ramaswamy, and they gave Vivek Ramaswamy the endorsement. There was a lot of pressure on Dave Yost to step out of that race, step back. And so he just after all that pressure, he did step back, and he's been looking for other opportunities where to go after he gets out of his office. And now he's going to be leaving office a little before he's finished the whole course. So,
yeah. Well, and I know Governor DeWine will be the one to appoint his replacement, and that could set off a statewide office kind of chain reaction. Explain why that is.
It could. You know, of course, Governor DeWine could come in and say, well, current auditor, let me just first say that all of the statewide office holders are playing musical chairs here. So they're all kind of running for another, except for Yost, they're all running for another office. So Auditor Keith Faber, our current auditor, is running for AG to replace Yost. So DeWine could come in and say, okay, well, Keith Faber, I'm going to make you the AG. But then if he does, then he has to, you know, replace the AG's position, the current AG's position. And that could set off, you know, taking the person who wants to, you know, move into that spot and another spot. So you could end up taking all of the Republicans on the primary ballot and reappointing them into places where they could run as incumbents. Now, if you do that, though, it's going to, the optics of that are not great. And number two, there are other options out there. Carol O'Brien, who has worked in the AG's office, has been mentioned as a possibility to take over until the end of this year. There's also other candidates around the state, people who could possibly step in and take over. So we'll just have to see where the governor goes with this and what he wants to do.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the other endorsements that Vivek Ramaswamy got was the endorsement from President Trump. And I know President Trump loomed large over several key primary races in Ohio and Indiana. Tom, let's start with you. How did defying the president come back to haunt incumbents in your state?
Well, it hit them pretty severely. There were Republican senators who voted against the redistricting bill back in December, who were on the ballot this year, and six of them lost. Only one of them has clearly won the primary, and one race is still, it's a 4-vote margin, I believe, and that's still some ballots being counted in that one. So it was a pretty sweeping victory for the pro-redistricting forces.
Wow. And that redistricting effort, that was part of President Trump's push to get congressional maps across the country redrawn. And Indiana kind of surprised folks when state lawmakers said no, right?
Yes. Trump had, you know, pushed it pretty heavily. Vice President Vance came into the state twice to meet with legislators to lobby them in favor of that. And it was quite the, you know, tightrope that legislators were walking of not wanting to catch the president's wrath. But he turned pretty strong against the Senate president and other anyone who wasn't in line on that issue, and made a lot of noise that he was drawing back primary challengers. And not only did President Trump give his endorsement to several challengers, more than $13 million was spent in Indiana on these primary races. And most of that was by outside national groups, a couple aligned with Indiana U.S. Senator Jim Banks, who is very pro-Trump, working against these incumbent senators, many of them who had been in office for 3, 4, 5 terms.
Wow. Well, Joe, I mentioned that President Trump endorsed Vivek Ramaswamy, I think, several times in the Republican gubernatorial primary in Ohio. How important was that endorsement for him, do you think?
Well, it's pretty important. Remember that President Trump won Ohio by 12 points back in 2024. There is still obviously a lot of support for him here. And so the idea that Vivek Ramaswamy got out there early, got President Trump's endorsement, got the endorsement of basically all the Republican establishment, that certainly helped him come to the top. And his competition, who was running against him, they really didn't have that kind of backing, okay? You had automotive designer Casey Puch from like Northwest Ohio. He launched a very late challenge in January, kind of promoting himself as a white Christian alternative to Vivek Ramaswamy's Indian heritage. And Puch got more than 17% of the vote. You had Heather Hill down. She was a Morgan County school board president, former, and she was on the ballot, was getting some votes during the early voting period, but got kicked off the ballot because she ended up, her and her lieutenant governor had a spat pretty public on social media. And they ended up splitting ways right before the election. And because of that, and because he officially withdrew from that race, her votes didn't count. So it really, when you look at Ramaswamy getting 82% of the vote, that's a pretty solid win for him.
Yeah. Well, Tom, you just mentioned that only one of the 8 senators who opposed the plan to redistrict and who were opposed by pro-redistricting groups was a clear winner. How do you think he was able to win against all those forces?
That was a unique one that was a 3-way race. It had two candidates, Brenda Wilson and Alexandra Wilson, on the ballot. And Brenda Wilson, who's a county council member over in the Terre Haute area, had been endorsed by Trump, and her backers claim that the incumbent Senator Greg Good and local Republican leaders found a candidate with the same last name and put her on the ballot. And so there was a little drama with that. Some of the Trump White House staffers had contacted Alexandra Wilson and tried to talk her into dropping off the ballot, you know, dangling prospects of, you know, being appointed to a state position. And that, so there were a lot of dynamics and some local factors in that race, but he was the only one to hold on. It was quite remarkable and some pretty wide margins that, 60% or more victories by the challengers in most of these races.
Wow. Tom, you mentioned how much money was spent on these races. Is that a whole lot more than typically gets spent on a state Senate race in Indiana?
Oh, most definitely. Ad Impact, the ad tracking service, projected about $13.5 million was spent on advertising this cycle, where 2 years ago it was, for the state Senate races, is more like $250,000. And in one race, very hotly contested up in the Lafayette, Indiana area, the incumbent senator raised and spent about $1 million, where estimates are there's about $2.5 million spent against him. When he won his first term 4 years ago in a pretty competitive primary up there, for the entire general and primary election, he spent about $200,000. So it's just orders of magnitude more than is typically spent in legislative races in Indiana.
Well, Tom, will this lead to a shakeup at the state house generally, all these incumbents losing to these Trump-backed candidates?
That's one thing that I was even making phone calls this morning trying to figure out. There's a lot of one thing that both the president and the governor had called for, the current Senate Republican leader Rod Bray, who voted against redistricting, to be removed as the Senate leader. But he has a lot of goodwill amongst the Republican senators, and he told me this week that he plans on seeking to remain in that position as the Senate leader. And it's unclear, you know, if anyone else has the votes to force him out. And it might not be decided until after the November election and see just what the makeup is of the Republican caucus. They're sure to retain. They have a 40-10 majority now in the Senate, and there's little chance of Democrats gaining the majority. But, you know, there's some of these, they're more optimistic to be able to gain some ground and be able to pick up some more seats.
Well, Tom, do the outcomes of these Indiana Senate races tell you anything about the power of the president's endorsement going into the midterms?
It's the pro-Trump folks certainly think that it was the deciding factor, and they've been heavily touting that, pointing to actions in other states, Tennessee and elsewhere this week, that have jumped on with redistricting in the wake of the Voting Rights Act decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, they've been pointing to that, say the election results here in Indiana, say that Republicans better get in line and do what the president wants in this regard, or you'll see what the same thing happened in your state that happened in Indiana.
Joe, are you hearing any buzz about that in Ohio? I mean, is the Trump endorsement still expected to carry a lot of weight in the midterms in November?
Well, if you look at the numbers from this week, I would be inclined to say yes. But we also are hearing a lot of people start to question whether President Trump's policies are helping or hurting them. We're seeing the $5 a gallon gas or close to it up here in some parts of Columbus. People are not happy about that. The cost of living has gone up, even though, you know, some people will tell you it's good, especially Republicans will say it's gone down. But, you know, people go to the grocery every day and they see their bill. So they know what they're dealing with. So if that goes on for a longer period of time, running into the fall, the thinking is that President Trump might not be as popular going into the fall. But right now, it looked like it could have helped in the primary. One thing, though, that was interesting, Lucy, is that the Ohio House and Senate, the leadership there, they have traditionally opposed these former Republicans or current Republicans who supported Jason Stevens for House Speaker a couple years ago. They went along with Democrats, gave enough numbers to take out the leader of the House that most of the Republicans had wanted. So ever since then, there's been this hot water. All these candidates have been a hot water when they've gone for primaries. And we saw the former Speaker, Jason Stevens, he had a primary candidate, but he won. He won his race. And a lot of the other so-called blue 22 candidates won their race. So, you know, even though Trump might be, pulling in the votes for, you know, the top of the ticket, at least at that level, on that lower level, it doesn't look like the Senate and the House leadership had such good outcome.
Well, Joe, let's get back to the top of the ticket in Ohio. I want to talk a little bit more about the governor's race. Vivek Ramaswamy will face Dr. Amy Acton in November. She didn't have a challenger in the Democratic primary. What kind of chances do you think she has in this race?
Well, you know, from looking at what we've seen so far in elections, you might say, okay, she's got a huge race ahead of her. And we also see some polling. I don't know how much stock you can put in it, but the polling shows that the race is pretty close. Okay. But there was one thing that when you're drilling down in the numbers after the fact, there are 1.4 GOP voters in Ohio, Republican voter, 1.4 million GOP voters in Ohio, and 817,000 of them voted in this primary. Now, we're not sure who they voted for, right? But then there's a total of 781,000 registered Democrats in Ohio, and 762,000 voted for Acton. Now, you know, there's no way you can say all the affiliated Democrats came out to vote in the primary, because that just never happens on either side. Mm-hmm. So that suggests that there may be some new voters out there, or there may be some crossover voters that came out to vote for Amy Acton. And while she does have, you know, a lot of the Republicans are railing on her for her actions during COVID. You know, you remember she was the health director back then. She signed orders that shut down businesses for a short period of time, made a lot of controversial decisions. But of course, the top Republican in the state, Governor DeWine, has said, hey, wait, those were my calls. She didn't make any of those calls on her own. It was me. The buck stops with me. So I think a lot of people, though, who are going out and seeing Dr. Acton are excited about her for those very reasons, because, you know, while some people thought all those shutdowns and all the things that happened during COVID was a bad thing for her, and calling her doctor lockdown and different things, there are other people who thought she protected Ohioans and kept them safe during a very difficult time. So when she goes out on the trail, you'll see voters who come over to her and thank her for taking stands that maybe weren't so popular back then, but they feel were crucial. So your answer to your question, don't count the Democrats out, but, you know, right now it is a very competitive race.
Well, that'll be a good one to watch, I'm sure. I've been talking with Indiana Capital Chronicle Deputy Editor Tom Davies and Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks.
Up next, how a challenger defeated the incumbent in the Democratic primary for Hamilton County Commissioner. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati City Councilmember Mika Owens had a decisive win in the Democratic primary for Hamilton County Commissioner, defeating incumbent Stephanie Sumaro Dumas. Joining me now to talk about that race and how Mika Owens won are Cincinnati Enquirer opinion editor Kevin Aldridge. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks, Lucy. Good to be here.
Good to have you. And WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thanks for being here, Becca.
Happy to be here, Lucy.
Well, Becca, as I mentioned, City Council Member Mika Owens won this Democratic primary for Hamilton County Commissioner. How did the vote break down? How big a win was it?
So it was a three-way race between Owens and incumbent Stephanie Sumaro Dumas and then a third candidate, Herman Najoli. Owens secured just shy of 52% of the vote. That's about 33,000 votes in this election. Turnout is always a lot lower in a primary and a midterm year, not in a presidential year. Incumbent Stephanie Sumaro Dumas got 41%. That breaks down to about 7,000 votes behind Mika Owens. And then Herman Najoli got about 7% of the vote.
Well, and Councilmember Owens had just been reelected to city council, Becca, when she announced this run for county commissioner. How did she explain her decision to run?
That's right. She was sworn in for this third term on city council in early January. And a couple of weeks later, we found out that she was running for this seat. She says that the city has seen success with programs like eviction prevention, which is something that Owens has been very involved with at City Hall. But that program is limited to helping only city residents because it's funded by city tax dollars. And so she wants to scale that up countywide. I'd say that seems to be kind of the primary issue for her here, but she's kind of expanded that messaging to other issues like climate mitigation and building more housing in general, things that she says have been successful while she's been on city council, and she wants to broaden that out. As for why she ran against Sumaro Dumas specifically for this seat, it may just be a matter of timing and when she decided she wanted to run for something else, but Owens has been somewhat critical of Sumaro Dumas's public conflicts with Commissioner Alicia Reese on what Owens says has been some personal issues, not professional, not, you know, policy related. And so there were some criticisms of that as well.
Well, Kevin, were you surprised that Councilmember Owens won, or by the margin that she won?
Yeah, I think it was more the margin that she won by than that she won. I had thought this was going to be a pretty close race all along, but I thought, you know, Dumas might have had an advantage because she was the incumbent, because she was pretty much, she had name recognition, she performed well in Cincinnati suburbs. I figured Owens would probably do well in the city. I was curious to see how she was going to do in some of the suburban areas. And she actually, I think, outperformed my expectations, particularly in places where, you know, Dumas was strong, in Forest Park, where she was the mayor there, and also in places like Lincoln Heights. So I think that's a testament to Mika Owens' campaign machine that she had, as well as the amount of funds that she was able to raise.
Kevin, why do you think that margin matters so much? And what do you think was really behind her win? How did she do it?
Well, I think it's a clear statement that people wanted a change. I think, you know, my personal opinion was, I think Mika Owens sort of saw Stephanie Dumas as the weaker candidate among the commissioners. So she was the one most susceptible to being picked off. I think you would have probably had a different outcome had it been her against Denise Driehaus or Alicia Reese, who are candidates who have, you know, strong backing, strong name recognition and history.
Yeah, decades of other political experience.
Right. And so Dumas was ripe for the picking off, because I think, you know, even going back to when she beat Chris Monzel, I think what was that, in 2012 or something like that? That was a big surprise at that time. And I think a lot of people credited that to the blue wave that kind of came through at that time. And she was a beneficiary of that. And then when she was reelected again 4 years later, again, Democratic politics had seemed to take had been taking a stronghold in Hamilton County. And so it seemed like she was kind of riding that wave up until this year, where she came into competition with a Democratic candidate who had, you know, pretty good name recognition herself and really good skills at organizing.
Well, and the Hamilton County Democratic Party decided not to endorse in this race. Becca, what was behind that decision?
Yeah, well, it wasn't a unanimous decision. So the decision about whether to endorse in a primary election is, you know, a topic of some debate nationally and locally. So the way it worked locally is a smaller a group of the party, a committee, interviewed both Samora Dumas and Mika Owens, and they recommended that Samora Dumas get the endorsement from the party, and she would have appeared on that sample ballot that was passed out at polls that has a lot of power for voters who are going to the polls. But the larger body debated the issue for some time. Mika Owens asked them not to endorse a candidate, saying, you know, let the voters decide who the best Democrat is to move forward to November. It broke down to a vote of about 60 against endorsement and 25 in favor. So the majority of the party ended up deciding, and this is a bit of a complicated thing with precinct executives and stuff like that, but that's who decided, and they decided not to endorse.
Huh. Kevin, how big a factor do you think that was?
Yeah, I won't go so far as to say it was a deciding factor, but it definitely weakened Dumas without question. I mean, I think it just goes back to, again, when you look at the overall political strategy of Mika Owens, even in terms of lining up her support and her people for that meeting that Becca talked about, where they decided not to endorse, was a part of political strategy where I think Stephanie Dumas had let her guard down a little bit, whereas I'm not sure how much support she had in the room at that meeting where she could have maybe argued more vociferously for her to get that endorsement. And I definitely think, you know, the Democratic endorsement has been a strong compass for voters in Cincinnati. And so you can't say it didn't hurt her. But I also won't go so far as to say that even with that, would that have made a difference in the outcome?
And why is that? Do you think it's just Mika Owens' organization, the people her campaign machine, as you put it earlier?
Yeah, I do. And I also think it speaks to the strength of the candidate. Now, while Stephanie Dumas, I think, had done a fine job as a commissioner, I don't think there's anything that you could overtly point to say that she didn't deserve to get reelected. But I do think some of the more public disagreements with Alicia Reese, those sorts of things, I think they do stick with people. And I think it comes down to, you know, who do you want to see representing you? Who do you think may be the best candidate for the future? Stephanie Dumas, some people might have looked at as maybe more of an old school candidate, and, you know, a younger Mika Owens coming into it, fresh face, fresh ideas, voters may have responded to it in that way. So I think Mika Owens' star was rising, and I think that was always going to be something that was going to be a little bit of a challenge for Dumas.
You mentioned, Kevin, how Mika Owens performed in the suburbs. I mean, you expect her to be strong in the city of Cincinnati, where she's been a council member and has done well in the council race. I know your colleague Aaron Glenn at the Inquirer just reported how much Owens outperformed Dumas in the city, and that Stephanie Samora Dumas did better in the suburbs where there are fewer Democrats, but there were those places where Mika Owens made gains. I mean, yeah. I assume you looked at Aaron's map and her reporting.
Yeah.
Like, what do you make of all that?
Yeah, again, I think that's getting out, that's showing up, that's having the money to be able to get your message out, you know, to those areas as well. It, you know, it's typical election 101. You want to run up the numbers where you're strong. So she had to, you know, really run up the numbers in the city of Cincinnati to contend with what Dumas was going to do in the suburbs. And then in the suburbs, you don't have to necessarily beat her. You just have to nibble into the margins so she's not beating you by as many votes in those areas. And I think she did that. I think she did that, obviously did that effectively enough to create, you know, the 10-point margin to win. But yeah, I mean, when you have $45,000 to spend compared to, you know, a little less than 10 for your opponent, a 4-to-1 difference, that makes a difference in what you can do. Now, I'm sure Dumas would say, you know, the controversial campaign mailers that came out, I guess, over the weekend before the election, which Owens has denied any connection to, that probably hurt a little bit. How much, you know, that's kind of anecdotal, and you can't really put a thumb on how much damage that might have actually, you know, did to Dumas at the end. But I'm sure it might have changed some of the more low information voters, folks who hadn't really quite been paying attention as much. You know, that could turn, you know, a few hundred votes in your favor.
Yeah. I want to come back to that. But first, Kevin, you mentioned the suburbs and how Stephanie Sommaro-Dumas was talking about the suburbs a lot in her campaign. Does it tell you anything about the focus of the commission? Do you think voters in the suburbs think the commission is paying enough attention to the suburbs? Do you think that played a role at all?
Yeah, I think that's always the question. I mean, let's just go back to the incident that we had in Lincoln Heights, the unfortunate incident in Lincoln Heights with the neo-Nazis showing up out there. And I think there was some sentiment that you heard from folks even out in Lincoln Heights in those areas at that time about, you know, how much attention the county was paying to issues out there, whether you're talking about sheriff's patrols or things of that nature out in that area. So I think there probably is some sense out in the suburbs that, you know, that folks want to make sure that they're getting paid attention to as well. Now, the thing I would say with that is you've just elected somebody who comes from Cincinnati City Council. So there might be a fear that there could be too much focus on the city of Cincinnati with somebody who's coming from that. But I think Owens did herself a favor by talking about wanting to take some of the successes that they've had in the city and growing them out into other parts of the county. So we'll see.
Yeah. Becca, how did Commissioner Sommaro-Dumas react to the results on election night? What did she have to say?
She was largely positive. You know, she says she's focused on finishing out her term, which goes through the end of the year. That's quite a bit of time to know that you're not going to be out of a job soon. The county will pass another annual budget in December. So that's a big task that she says she's happy to be involved in. She says she was surprised, but not surprised by the results. She pointed to what she calls dirty politics that she says affected the results. I think she also has talked about, you know, low turnout, which again, low turnout is often low in a primary election.
Now, when she said dirty politics, was she talking about that mailer that Kevin referenced?
She was. And I do think some context on that is useful. So the mailer that's being talked about, it was not sent by Mika Owens' campaign. And it has to do with these very, very small local level elections for precinct executives within the Democratic Party. So a precinct is an area that has no more than 1,400 voters of any party. And the mailer only went to the precinct in which Mika was running for precinct executive. It was a mailer specific to that race, not her race for county commission. Now, that doesn't mean it wasn't confusing or, you know, potentially misleading, but the actual mailer went to very, very few voters. And remember, Stephanie Sommaro-Dumas lost by almost 7,000 votes. So it seems unlikely that had much of an impact. Now, of course, it was also shared on social media. The kind of dirty part of it comes into play where the mailer had a few elected officials, Denise Driehaus, Mayor Aftab Pureval, and a state representative, Cecil Thomas. And saying support, you know, these Democrats and, you know, voting for Mika Owens for precinct executive. People questioned that, you know, did they really get this endorsement? This seems really suspicious. Cecil Thomas came out and said that he feels that he was misled and that he did not endorse Mika Owens for county commission and that he himself voted for Stephanie Sommaro-Dumas. A bit of confusion there again, because the mailer was specific to the precinct executive race and not to the county commission race. All of that being said, other dirty politics things I think Sommaro-Dumas was referring to, she said there were a lot of debates this primary election. We hosted one along with the Inquirer here at WVXU. And, you know, with the nature of debates, there's often limited time for response. And Sommaro-Dumas said she felt like misinformation was shared during those debates that she didn't have the opportunity to respond to and kind of correct the record for voters.
Well, Becca, just quickly, who will Mika Owens be running against in November?
Well, there was an uncontested primary for the Republicans. So Jonathan Pearson will be on the ballot in November to run against Mika Owens. The deadline to have an independent candidate in the race has already passed and nobody signed up. So it'll just be a two-way race.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and Cincinnati Inquirer opinion editor Kevin Aldridge. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you.
Up next, we used to watch WKRP on TV. Now we can really listen on the radio. This is Cincinnati Edition.
Wondered what ever became of me. I'm living on the air in Cincinnati. Cincinnati, WKRP.
For many of us of a certain age, even loyal listeners of WBXU, when we think about radio in Cincinnati, the fictional WKRP comes to mind. Now, nearly 50 years after the debut of the sitcom WKRP in Cincinnati, there's a real WKRP on the local airwaves. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to explain is WBXU media beat writer John Kiesewetter. Welcome back, John.
Thanks, Lucy. So that might have been a first, that the KRP theme was played on WVXU.
Well, you would know better than anyone if that was a first. John, I actually want to start with remembering Ted Turner. He was known around the world for being a cable TV pioneer, the founder of CNN, but he got his start here in Cincinnati, right?
He was born here in 1938, and his first media job was selling the Enquirer at a trolley stop at the Cincinnati Zoo. And he was oftentimes at the TV writers press tours that I would attend. And whenever he saw my name badge, John Kiesewetter, Cincinnati Enquirer, he'd start going, extra, extra, read all about it, and reverted to an 8-year-old selling newspapers at the trolley stop.
Oh, my gosh. So what did he say he remembered most about living in Cincinnati?
The zoo. He loved to ride his bike over to the zoo. He lived on Golson Avenue. And when he came back in the late 1990s to do a conservation speech for a series at the zoo, he talked about how he loved to look at the animals and was fascinated learning that some of the animals didn't exist anymore. And so the zoo made the biggest impact on him.
So how did Ted Turner get his start in the TV business?
Well, he was his dad ran an advertising. The family moved to Georgia when he was 9. So late 40s, right after the war, his dad ran an advertising billboard. In fact, around town, you used to be able to see it across the bottom of it had the word Turner. It was that company. And he started working for his dad. And in 1963, his dad committed suicide. Oh. And he took over the company. And then in 1970, he bought the equivalent of Channel 19 in Atlanta, then Channel 17. And he got the idea to put it on satellite, make it available everywhere. And it was the first cable superstation. And people would watch Andy Griffith and his Atlanta Braves, which he also owned. And so that's how he got into television.
Wow. And he launched the Cable News Network, now better known now as CNN, in 1980. How was that received initially?
Many people called it the chicken noodle news. it's hard to conceive of in today, but for someone to think that there was a 24-hour news cycle, that there's always going to be news. If there's breaking news, they'd have it, or they'd refresh news. And it was mostly news, not news talk as CNN and Fox and so many are then. And Bernard Shaw told me, he was their anchorman, used to work at CBS, went to the 1980 national convention, and they didn't let him in because they didn't know what CNN was. It had just started 2 months earlier.
Wow. Well, then he debuted CNN Headline News, later CNN International premiered. How did all of that change the news landscape?
Greatly. I mean, like I said, the 24-hour news cycle, CNN Headline actually began as a half-hour newscast repeated and updated 24 hours a day. Both of those, I mean, have given us long before the internet that we could tune in there to see what was going on at any hour of the day. He had said that a lot of times he got home, it was after 6:30, 7 o'clock, so he'd missed the national and local news in Atlanta, and he might be in bed before the 11 o'clock news. And it was a very expensive undertaking. People thought he was crazy, but he was really quite a visionary to see this and fill it. And so he owned it and ran it till it wasn't Fox News, didn't come along till like 16 years later, and
wow.
MSNBC.
Yeah. So he was known also for his big personality. How did he earn the nickname Captain Outrageous?
Actually, he was had a yacht and had competed in the America's Cup, and it was called I think it was called Courageous. He was known as Captain Courageous, but to those who had a write about him, he became Captain Outrageous or the Mouth of the South. I mean, when I'd go to the press tour, and I for about 15 years, I went twice a year. It was if he was on the list lineup of people, I knew I could. I mean, he was just like Pete Rose. He could fill a notebook with quotes and outrageous statements or whatever. He was a reporter's dream to cover.
He was also known for his philanthropic work. Can you talk about what he was most passionate about there?
He was very passionate about world peace and the environment. I mean, he conceived of the idea of Captain Planet, that cartoon series that ran on TBS and his other stations. He funded a lot and did a lot of TV special with Jacques Cousteau, and we probably met him two or three times on press tour as well about funding his expeditions and also then coming back and making an hour documentary about it. When he sold CNN or Turner Broadcasting and merged with Time Warner in 1996, he got like $7 billion. He gave $1 billion to the United Nations.
Wow.
And later in life, he's one of the biggest private landowners in Nebraska and in Montana and has 10,000 bison.
Mm. In so many ways, Ted Turner changed our relationship with news and even human behavior. I mean, before smartphones, he was giving us news on demand. How do you think he'll be remembered?
I think he'll be remembered as the visionary who conceived and started CNN, put a lot at risk. It wasn't a cheap undertaking to staff it 24 hours and then to have the bureaus. It really came to fore in 1991 at Desert Storm when Peter Arnett and Bernard Shaw and John Holloman stayed in Baghdad and did live reporting and had live video and live kind of play-by-play, about like how Edward R. Murrow did from the London rooftops in the 1940s during World War II. And that really, you know, made it clear the value of CNN.
Well, let's talk about some memories that a lot of us here in Cincinnati value, and that's WKRP, the beloved sitcom. WKRP is finally a real radio station
right
in Cincinnati. How'd that happen?
The call letters had been around in my 45 years covering media. It had been in Georgia, Indiana, and most recently, we're on a low-power station in Raleigh, North Carolina, WKRP LPFM. And the owners of it decided to offer them for sale to a full power FM, also for AM or TV. And Randy Michaels used to run the Q102, ran WLW and Clear Channel, bought them and put them on a format that we have in town called the Oasis. But it's basically music from the late 60s to 1980, which is basically the music, the rock music that KRP played. And so they've got a pretty good little niche there for their music, but by calling it WKRP in Cincinnati, it gives them immediate branding. They just rebranded the station. They didn't change the music.
Huh. So are these stations going to have Dr. Johnny Fever DJs or a turkey drop at Thanksgiving?
I'm told there will be a promotion of some sort at Thanksgiving involving turkeys, but probably not live turkeys being dropped by a helicopter.
Lord, I hope not.
No, they said it's more of a sensibility, more of an attitude, although I've told them that they could use Dr. Johnny Fever's line of more music, less Nesman. Or unlike Herb Tarlick's leisure suits, the music on WKRP in Cincinnati never went out of style.
Oh, nice. Well, they had a former WKRP cast member kind of do the big introductions, right?
Right. Gary Sandy, who grew up in Dayton, but he has a farm probably 40, 50 miles from Northern Kentucky. And they got him he actually introduced the station at 6 a.m. this past Monday.
Wow.
And that he's done some of the liners and stuff for them. And it wouldn't surprise me if on down the road at a big public event or party that he comes and signs autographs and helps promote the station.
So what kind of reach are these stations going to have?
There's three of them.
Mm-hmm.
The WKRP calls are on 97.7, which is broadcast off the Middletown Tower. It used to be in Oxford as 97X, and it reaches from like I-70 in Dayton to Northern Kentucky. And then there's a 106, I think 0.7, is in Dry Ridge. So that reaches like from Georgetown, Kentucky to the Ohio River. And then they've last year added a third station in Dayton. So that reaches from, covers Dayton better and reaches all the way up almost to Sydney.
Huh. One of the things that made WKRP in Cincinnati, the show, so cool was the music it played. And that was current rock music at the time. And they had a big influence on some bands, didn't they?
They did, and the DJs, the people who played the DJs, Tim Reed as Venus Flytrap and Howard Hessman as Dr. Johnny Fever, actually picked some of their own music. And then record companies began pitching them, and Blondie's Heart of Glass first played by WKRP, and it got to be a gold record. And actually, the record label sent KRP a gold record, and it was on the wall back in the DJ bullpen area in a later season.
This show, I mean, I remember watching it as a kid and just howling with laughter with my family, especially over the Thanksgiving turkey drop episode. But it was only around for four seasons. What happened? Why did it go away?
It was around for four seasons. CBS just didn't get it. It came on in September the first year. But for November sweeps, they pulled it, put in something else, and it didn't come back to January. And over the four-year span of the WKRP, it was in either 12 different time periods or nights. It just bounced all over the schedule. And after they canceled it in May, that summer, the fourth summer, it took off in reruns, and it was a top 10 show. And even they saved back one episode. So the night after the Emmys, it was up for an Emmy but didn't win. The next night, they ran the last original one, and it beat Little House on the Prairie. It had bigger ratings than MASH, and it had bigger ratings than Monday Night Football. But by that time, all the cast members had moved off to other shows, and they couldn't put the genie back in the bottle.
This story about WKRP in Cincinnati being a real radio station now has been huge locally. It made news across the country. Why do you think WKRP resonates with people so much?
Part one is it resonates with anybody who's in radio. I mean, they would say, oh, I work with a guy like Johnny Fear. I work with a guy like Les or Herb. Part of it was such an iconic show and so Cincinnati specific. That and well done. You talked about laughing at it. It's still very funny, but I don't think it's on the air now because of the music rights problem. It's just too expensive to run it with the original music. But it's always been one of those things. WKRPs. I've seen stories in Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, Deadline, People. Everybody's picked up on it.
Yeah. And sir, okay. So my husband got me a WKRP in Cincinnati t-shirt. Every time I wear it, people stop. Oh my gosh, I love that show. People stop me.
I have one for the first annual turkey drop.
Well, I've been talking with WBXU media beat writer John Keysweater. Thank you so much for your time today, John, and for your reporting.
Thanks for the invitation. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Up and down the dial. Once in a while.